Kia ora and welcome to Sobriety Chat. I am your host, Lotta Dan, otherwise known as Mrs. D. I am the community manager and content creator here at Living Sober. And today I'm joined by the gorgeous, as you can see, Carmel Claridge. Now, Carmel is many things. She's a partner, a mum, a daughter, a sister, a very proud grandma of four delicious grandbabies. She has a legal background, which she's currently using in her role as a court coordinator. We'll hear more about that. And, of course, she is a sober hero. Welcome, Carmel.
Kia ora, Lotta. Thanks for having a chat with me today.
Oh, so good. Because we met at a work hui last week and we had a brief chat and I just had the sense of, oh, I want to talk to her more. And so it's really great. And you know, for our members at Living Sober, many of whom are in those early stages of quitting, they're kind of grinding through those tough, you know, phases at the start. They just love hearing from people who are further down the track. So how long have you been sober for?
14 years.
Amazing.
It's still a case of pinching myself. Almost every day about how great my life is today as a sober woman. Yeah, it's been an incredible journey. I've had some highs and lows, of course, such as life, but it's brought me to a really, really wonderful place in my life. Yeah, so
amazing.
Cannot speak highly enough of living a sober life.
I know, and if we could bottle this feeling and, you know, sell it, we'd be rich women. But do you mind if I take you back a little just to share a little bit about your story and what got you into recovery? You know, as much as you or as little as you want to share, how did your drinking story go? When did you start and how did it develop across
Gosh. I remember very vividly the first time I got properly savagely drunk. Was at my mate Tracy's house, Springfield Road, St Albans in Christchurch, where I was living at the time. I was in the fourth form at school, so I would have been about 14 years old. We had a house to ourselves, no parental supervision. The group of kids would have been between the ages of 13 and 15 and a room full of booze. Yeah, and there were so many things about that night that were so horrible, so horrible. I broke Tracy's mum's antique table, the one nice piece of furniture that she had, snapped it in half by jumping on it, spent a good part of the night throwing up, you know, in a big stainless steel cooking bowl on the couch, and then someone said, "Oh, have this, it'll make you feel better." And it was Karuba, what was that? Karuba rum Coke. Remember Karuba rum? So got drunk, threw up, but then started drinking again so I could get buzzy again. As I said, you know, so horrible in so many ways, and yet I yearned to do it again. You know, I wanted to do it again as soon as I could. And from then on, pretty much my weekends were, you know, where's the party? You know, where's the party where I can go for it with the booze?
Yeah.
You know, that went on for a long, long time. And drinking was very normalised for young people in my peer group. Getting into pubs underage wasn't a problem. Christchurch in those days. I was first caught underage at the age of 15 at the Hillsborough Tavern.
I remember the Hillsborough Tavern. I was caught underage at the, what was it called in Sumner? No, it was the Heathcote Inn.
And then there was
we're from the same neighbourhood, so it would have been the Caledonian.
The Charlton. And there was one in the square. Now, what was that called? It started with a W, with the Irish band.
Warners. We probably bumped into each other, honestly.
We were probably there together, same time, same place.
And just like you, I was the same. The minute I touched it, I loved it. And it just did what I wanted. And I understand what that is now that I'm in my 50s and in recovery. But at the time, I didn't know. I thought it was just being cool and fun. I didn't realize the other impact it was having on me. But let's get to that stuff in a minute. How did it go for you? So it was all fun and games and partying. Was that through your 20s and 30s? How did things track for you?
No, well, of course, university was great. I designed my whole curriculum around happy hour, the $1 drugs. But drinking and doing life, I was able to juggle at that stage. So I was still, tracking through life really well. And achieving really well, and got a couple of degrees under my belt, and academically was always very sort of up there, and kind of, I guess in many ways, certainly within my family, was looked as being, oh, she's the successful one, she's the one who's going to do really important things, and she's going to be top of her field and everything. And my siblings loathed it, of course. Oh, perfect caramel. So I married very young, had three children quite early in life, became almost by, and I'm not quite sure how this happened, but fell into, it was my choice as well, but became a very traditional stay-at-home mother to a high-achieving partner as they worked their way up the legal ranks. And again, alongside that still was drinking and yahooing and brief periods where I stopped when I was pregnant, but only because I was horribly sick, had morning sickness. It wasn't out of any great concern for my children. I still did things then in my 20s, early 30s that in hindsight were really dysfunctional. I drove drunk with babies and toddlers in the car. I'd turn up to playgroups, sometimes with a couple of bottles of wine, hoping that, the other playgroup mums would join me. And occasionally they did. And I'd be sort of three sheets to the one, by 5 o'clock, I was kind of well and truly pissed. In those days, drinking a lot was almost celebrated, particularly in the culture in which I kind of loved that the legal fraternity, and the Friday night drinks and the partners retreats.
And all of our society, let's be honest. I mean, by this stage, alcohol's in the supermarkets, it's readily available everywhere and cheap. I mean, we are in an environment of, this is a normal thing, everyone does it.
And the people who didn't drink, and I remember a couple who, and they were Christian and they didn't drink for their own reasons, but I can remember the ridicule that they used to get at functions. It was quite pathetic, really. This is going back a long time, this is 25 years ago or so, but I hope that we've come a bit further along.
I think it's shifting. There's still pockets where you do get, like I've always say, it's the only drug that you're judged for not taking.
Taking it. No one questions if you decide that, no, actually, I'm not going to have pee today, or I'm going to,
That's right. What do you mean you're not having heroin? But, Carmel, I want to go back because I just had this image of you, this kind of, studying and degrees and marriage and babies and wine. And when you look back at that woman, who was ticking all the boxes of life, success, doing everything, being the perfect person that you been pitched as from a young age, how do you feel about her and how she was actually feeling inside? Because it sounds like there was a lot going on. And you were sort of somewhat lost in that, I don't know.
I was completely lost. I had no idea who I was. All of that external validation that I was desperate for, it was all about the portrayal of, let's make everything look good, right down to going to the gym all the time, obsessively, so even your body has to be perfect. So creating this image, and yet inside, and I used to Remember once at the gym, someone said to me, "Oh, everybody's so envious of you." And I felt like, you have no idea how rotten I feel inside. You have no idea. So externally, I had everything, right? Internally, I was lost. I had no sense of purpose in my life. I didn't know who I really was. I felt like I was living a life that was completely out of kilter with my values. I'd kind of parked all of my sort of personal ambition in a way, in the sense that, oh, Matthew's doing all that for me. I don't need to do that anymore. And I'd become very, I was carried along by life rather than, so I was like I was on an escalator that I had no power over myself or no control over myself. And life was just something that happened to me.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of that is, you know, I can't blame others for that. A lot of that was, it was easier to do that. So I took that path.
Yeah.
I didn't have to work, so I didn't. But then I became increasingly angry and resentful.
Mm.
But my default feeling for most of that period of time was sad. I was sad all the time. You know, I was sad and disappointed in myself all the time. Mm. And never felt that I was doing something worthwhile. So, yeah, alcohol was great in that it
worked.
Well, it made you feel, I mean, it just made me feel better than myself.
Yeah. I get exactly what you mean. Yeah. So what happened? How did you get to where you're in a different life?
The point of change. I think that like most people, I have those kind of life markers which will push you in one direction or the other. And my first marriage failed. And I was on my own, trying to negotiate life now as a single woman with three young children, had a huge gap away from the workforce. Oh, I dabbled, Lotta. You know, I dabbled. I'd done the rich housewife kind of little bits on the side here and there, but not proper, not real sort of career path work or anything like that. So struggling to get back into some kind of means of looking after myself. And I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I couldn't get my shit together. I was hopeless. I was useless, you know. And look, admittedly, it was, it was a very, very difficult few years. The extricating myself from the marriage was difficult, and there were legal proceedings involved. It was enormously stressful.
And parenting is relentless and stressful.
And I didn't do what I should have done, which was to, you know, ask for support and help and lean on my friends and look after myself. My coping mechanism was booze, of course, you know. So off I went, and there was no handbrake anymore. So I had no one to sort of roll their eyes or tut-tut or, you know, nobody to sort of question what I was doing. So off I went. And oh boy, did I go for it. So yeah, that was when things really escalated. My mental health became very, very poor. So I'd struggled with depression when my children were younger, but during this phase, my mental health it really did deteriorate in a way that was quite disturbing. But at the same time, I didn't get proper help with that and self-medicated using alcohol, which of course exacerbates it. So yeah, things were really starting to get bad. I was so lonely. I was so lonely. I mean, it was just such a horrible time. And the only way I could deal with the terrible feelings of failure, because of course I outwardly had this and had materially, I'd gone from a, you know, really, really high earning household to next to nothing. Mm. I managed to get myself a job back in law as an older woman returning to the workforce, essentially working minimum wage. out at South Auckland, and I had my little boy in daycare and had to struggle to get there in time and paid late fees every... One of my girlfriends said, oh, you'd be better off on the DPB, girl, you know, what are you doing? But I really did try really hard to get my life back together. I really did. But alongside of that was my alcoholism.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah.
So what got you out?
What got me out? Oh, gosh.
14 years ago, what was the thing where you were
there was one thing. I chucked in the proper job. I gave up, really. I gave up even trying to live life normally. And I had a couple of years that were, I call it my twilight zone. So I started, it was almost like I'd given up even trying to rebuild a life. Self-worth was nothing. My older children had got sick to death of me. They didn't want anything more to do with me, not really. And besides, you know, by that stage, I was very mentally unwell. I was behaving very strangely, dipping into sort of psychosis and taking whatever was around that was on offer.
I'm so lost. It's just like hearing this and looking at you now, and you just, you know, and you're just so sort of gorgeous and groomed and articulate.
There's a film called Leaving Las Vegas, and there's a Nicolas Cage, and it shows it's just my partner putting the shiny BMW, and he's getting rid of, he's divesting himself of his past so that he can go to Las Vegas and drink. And when I watched that movie in recovery, I just wept, because that was me. I sold my house. I put all my belongings in storage. This was after I'd been sectioned and, you know, I'd given up well and truly.
Yeah.
But my life became, I didn't really have a life. Lotta, it was like I was getting ready to leave. So my furniture was in storage. I'd sold my house. I also was I had no proper income. You know, I was cleaning the odd sort of person's house and that sort of thing, but I was living off credit cards, selling jewelry. It was chaos. So I no longer had a home. Okay. And I was just careering around and bounced around various men, and became very, very disconnected from reality, very disconnected. But I can see, looking back, I was quite systematic in getting rid of anything that required any sort of responsibility from myself.
Right.
I can remember my youngest son was still kind of talking to me. And I remember being at a bar on a Friday I remember his little name coming up on my phone, and I just went and put it down. And the saddest thing is I didn't feel anything. So I didn't feel anything.
How can you when you're that numb from the alcohol?
Yeah, so...
I remember when we met, you saying that your drinking was kind of an out of the house around bars, whereas mine was inside behind closed doors.
So by the end, I was out there, and, you know, I was regularly getting picked up by the police and taken back to wherever I was staying at the time, and getting into fights, breaking things, driving around drunk as a skunk. So I became the sort of person that I used to look at with contempt and disdain. I was a bar hoe. You know, I was a sad middle-aged barho. That was just, I didn't care. Nothing mattered to me anymore. I was, you know, I was totally oblivious. It was just like, whatevs. So I was ready to go. You know, I was ready to go. I was just waiting for something to take me out, quite frankly, Lotta, you know. I had a nice little stash of pills by this stage too that I used to cut. That's like, you know, my little stash that I was slowly building. I was in my own strange way being quite methodical. I even gave away my dog. I gave away my dog. No, I can't be looking after a dog anymore. Yeah. So there was nothing that I no longer had any reminders of my family, so any photos and whatever, gone. So all I had was, you know, the bag of makeup, a couple of suitcases of my clothes and my shoes and my car.
Yeah.
And I'd sold my house, so I had access to money. So I was
just cutting off everything that had mattered because you didn't want to feel the pain.
I didn't want any anchors to remind me of what a shit heap my life was. You know, I didn't want reminding. And that's the thing about people will often go to detox or go to a rehab or whatever. But the problem is you've got to be prepared to face that wreckage. And I believe it's looking at the wreckage in the cold, hard light of day will drive most people back to the drink because you don't want to face it. It's like, I don't want to know.
Yeah.
I don't want to look at it like that. So I was disassociated completely. So I'd watch myself kind of doing all of this weird, chaotic, dysfunctional, crazy woman stuff. So I was like, I was watching myself and I'd become like, yeah, that's interesting. Oh, you're doing that now. Oh, that's kind of weird. Oh, but hey.
Gosh.
So, yeah, it was my way of
separation.
Yeah, completely separated. So it's like I was watching a movie of myself.
Mm.
In my last days of drinking. So what happened? Okay, so, by this stage I'd become quite a violent person. It was not unusual to get into physical fights, particularly with men. And there was a guy that I was seeing, and I went round to his house and we had a big fight. And I remember him, we were fighting and we were on the stairs and he was sort of trying to push me down the stairs. And I remember kind of going limp and looking up at him and just saying, oh, for heaven's sake, just kill me. Just do it, just kill me. And it was just like everything kind of went silent and he even stopped and went, what the f-? And I kind of picked myself up, got myself home. The police arrived. At the place I was staying. Where was I staying? I can't even remember. But the police arrived and sat down and I can't really remember what I said, but they left. And I woke up in the morning and I was sitting there and there was a Eastern Bay Courier. Do you remember those Eastern Bay Couriers?
Yeah.
Yeah, those little Suburban. And I was sitting there and I was looking at my fingernails. I was just, I've got fake fingernails and there were coils of bloodied human skin under my fingernails. And I was looking at them and then I looked down and there was a little ad for AA.
Oh.
And I picked up my phone and I rang the number.
Oh.
And that was it. Haven't had a drink since. Yeah. So that I talked to that guy and his name was Dave. And Dave was lovely, Dave at the service centre. And he said, where do you live? You know, where do
this
you stay?
This is the AA guy.
This is the AA guy at the service centre. And he said, there's a meeting tonight at Victoria Ave in Remuera. Can you get yourself there? And I said, yeah, I can get myself there. And he said, look, if you can't get yourself there, someone will come and pick you up and take you. And I said, no, it's all right, I can get myself there. And I thought, oh, someone's going to pick up me and take me, really? And
amazing sense of care right from the get-go that someone would do that, you know, that you were, there was something there. But what I'm loving hearing is how you were doing everything in your power to end it, leave it, but there was some part of you that went, no, when right at the point where you'd gone, just take me out, kill me now,
I'm done, stick a fork in my eye,
that next day that made that call that was like, we're keeping you here. And then you started to fight.
Yeah. It's inexplicable by any kind of scientific metrics. It was a chain of a really small little, what I call my little miracles, my little chain of small miracles. The miracle that Dave answered that day, and Dave being Dave, and if you knew Dave, was very, very passionate about the work he did at the service centre and a very, you know, passionate member of the fellowship. And a very caring and loving guy. And yeah, and the people, when I arrived at the funny little citizens advice place in Vickiave and walked in, beans, it was Albert actually. He's actually become a really good friend. He's one of these friends of my partner. So life's so weird and it's coincidence. And he said, welcome, come in. Albert's a Cook Islander and he just has that natural sort of sense of, you know, making people feel welcome. He was the person at the door, come in. And I went in and people were just, people were just lovely. And it was just, I just felt a sense of, oh, I'm going to be safe here. It's going to be okay. And the things that, you know, I can't remember exactly what was said, but that just that feeling in that funny little room with the grotty little chairs and all these people, you know, various ages and mostly white because it was a meeting in Remuera, but, you know, from all different backgrounds and just sitting there and just the sense in the room of we've got you, you know. It's okay, we've got you. So, yeah,
the beginning. It's the hope and the warmth and the acceptance. And you find it in the rooms and you find it online. And to be honest with you, Carmel, that is the sense that we also have in our community here on the site, because people come in and we're online and we're typing to one another and we don't always know who each other is, but there's always this welcome, you're in the right place.
You're in the right place.
And that's why we love it.
And there's hope. And I'm not going to tell you how to do it, because if anyone said you have to do blah, blah, I would have gone, oh, fuck off.
Yeah.
Just like, here's my story, you know, and you hear your own story and the stories of others, and just the non-judgmental space where you can be totally yourself. And I can remember in those early days, I was so jittery, you know, I'd sitting still for an hour was a real big ask for me. And I'd sort of bob up and down and be in and out, and nobody people didn't bat an eyelid. And whatever you disclosed or told or said, it was just never, you know, there was never any shock or horror. It was just we get it. And I was very, very fortunate in that I was immediately surrounded by some very, very strong women in recovery. I'd had very bad relationships with men, you know, really dysfunctional, often violent and often very weird interactions with men. So the women were particularly good to be able to gravitate towards and feel safe with. I got a sponsor. I went through several sponsors in the beginning, but eventually got a sponsor who was very diligent about helping me through the steps, doing the actual steps. So it became for me, I'm a fast learner, and if you give me a project, I'm like, I dive in.
So you put all your energies into this work.
Oh man, I dived in. I went out, you know, I went out within a week, I had a new phone, so I didn't have my old contacts. So I was tempted to, you know, go back to that world. I bought a house to live in. I got my stuff out of storage. I started making a home. And I gave myself, I said, you've got 3 months. You're not going to worry about money, because I was always sort of, you know, I'd made a real mess of, you know, my finances, and luckily was left with enough to get my own home. But I, you know, I had no income coming in at that stage, so I was really scared about that. But I said, no, you've got 3 months. We're gonna do this AA stuff and get that embedded, and then you're going to worry about that. So for 3 months, I basically, all I did was go to AA meetings. I took up running, and I smoked furiously, packet of fags a day. I did my own detox. I was a bit naughty. So I had my Valium derivatives to cope with the insomnia and the DTs and things. So I slowly titrated the dose for that, because of course I'm a smart ass know all, and I can,
you know. Amazing. All those resources that you'd been putting into the chaos, you then put into the repair.
Doing the fellowship. I remember sitting, it was very, very early on, and I, you know, the steps are up on the wall. And I remember focusing on step two and just saying over and over and over again, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, came to believe that a power could restore, because for me too, it was my mental health and losing my losing my mind. Like I could lose everything else, but I'd had lost my mind. And that I'd lost my children, you know, I'd lost everything, but I'd lost my mind and all of this as well. So I didn't want that to ever happen again. So it was that step two. It was just like, yay! I was all in.
And so I'm interested, I mean, I can't keep you too long, and I would love to hear the whole of the story of the rebuild. But, you know, instead of going through all of that, I am really interested in talking to you in a broader sense around this emotional healing and rebuilding and management, or whatever you want to call it, which is, you know, a huge part of the work of recovery. And when we met at this HUI a couple of weeks ago, we spoke briefly about anger, and I said to you, it's not an emotion I'm very familiar with. I think I've squashed my anger down. I haven't been in touch with it. I don't use it. I don't feel it. I don't feel it. And why? Why don't I feel it? And it's something I'm working on at the moment, and it's hard for me because my default is being sad and crying.
Right.
And you did say to me that, you know, anger was a part of your, you know, the end of your drinking story. There was anger coming out. How are you now with anger, and what have you learned, and what can you help me with anger?
Well, this is I think particularly as women, and in our generation, is that women. And I don't like to sound too feminist here, but women aren't really often allowed to be angry in healthy ways. You know, we're not allowed to show anger. We develop these horrible passive aggressive, you know, nasty little ways of doing anger, or we internalize it ourselves. And when I had I'm not even trying to live an ordinary functional life. Oh my goodness, every little hurt and every little unexpressed concern and every, you know, sort of failure and disappointment came out in total rage. So I'd drink, and it was like a switch would go off, and I would just, the red mist would come down, and I'd just be filled with this inexplicable rage that which was part of my letting loose, you know, and part of the violence.
Yeah. Do you still get the sense of that now, or have you learned to manage it?
I don't get it at the intensity. So my emotions throughout sobriety have I don't have those awful spikes, you know, the dreadful lows, the intense rage. There's far more of that lovely middle ground of contentment and just that quiet, I don't call it my quiet joy. And I don't need those extremes anymore in the way that
I used to. Sometimes things go wrong, or treatment is bad or unfair, and being angry is okay, right? I mean, do you still...
Oh, without a doubt. But what I try to do now with anger, I mean, hey, don't get me wrong, you know, I'm still, God, I can be a she-devil from hell on a bad day, but I've become much, much better at explaining, you know, that with my partner, Bruce. It's like, instead of sort of erupting, though I do it, but I'll say, look, you've got to leave me alone right now. I'll explain where I'm at.
You've
got to really give me some space now. I never used to explain or articulate myself ever. So if I'm angry about something nowadays, I will try and articulate that in a way that is measured.
Doing that takes some of the heat out of it, doesn't it?
Oh.
Because you're also saying it out loud to yourself.
You've got to acknowledge it. And I think a lot of our problems with emotions is lack of acknowledgement of our emotion, and particularly with the whanau I work with, a lot of their sort of criminal, I guess, type behaviour stems from their inability to regulate their emotions. appropriately, so that they're, and if, hey, you know, anybody's got any, you know, reason to be angry and disenfranchised and feeling pissed off with the world at someone who's homeless with no resources in the middle of the Auckland CBD. So in many ways you can't kind of like point the finger, oh, you should just, you know, go and get a job. So, are you kidding me? So I prefer being angry to sad, Lotta. I prefer anger to sadness.
Because it's more active and more kind of,
I try and channel my anger now, and if something's making me angry, I'll try and chat, like I'll write a letter to Auckland Council, or I'll, you know. What can I do with this energy? What can I do with this energy? And sometimes it's just I'll go to the gym and lift some heavy weights. I'll go into the garden and pull the heads off my old dead roses. So there's nothing wrong with the emotion of anger. It's just how do we express it? And let yourself be angry. And, you know, if I had in my first marriage been able to articulate and express my hurt and anger, I'm sure we would have been a much healthier couple. You know, I'm not saying
I probably need to go to a counsellor rather than talk, you know, put this on you, but I just never feel angry. And there's things that I should be angry, like I'll say out loud, I should be angry about this, and here's why I should be angry, but I'll be crying and feeling sad and hurt. Like, I still default to the sad and hurt. Anyway, this is my thing to work on. But
you see, my mum does that, Lotta.
Yeah.
And I just want to shake her and say, you get it. When she gets angry, even if it's directed at me, I almost feel like
yes. Right, I'm going to work on this.
Anger has resulted in all kinds of phenomenal social change for the better.
Yeah, you're right.
So don't, as women, I think, stop feeling sad. I mean, feel sad, you know, but don't take situations that should make you feel angry and turn it into sadness. It's just like...
You're right. And there has been a few times recently where I've felt sad, but I've also been like, you know what, I'm sick of this, and I've put a boundary in place. So maybe I am feeling a little bit of anger because I'm putting new boundaries in place around stuff I've dealt with my whole life. And maybe that is coming from a place of subtle anger. I don't know. Anyway, let's not analyze me anymore. Before we
wrap up, I love hearing about why are people doing what they do or saying what they say. You sure was it your upbringing where you told you when nice girls don't, you know? Why are you so angry?
I was positioned in the family in a certain way. Anyway, let's not do this we'll do it another time. But I do want to hear a little bit more about your work before we wrap up, because you talked about the whānau that you work with, and I said in the intro that you're a court coordinator. So now you've come to a place where you're using your legal training.
Yeah. So I started off, you know, started back in the world working as a cleaner, you know, so right from the bottom. Well, not the bottom, I don't, but looking after other people's kids, but learning to take some pride and learning to build, you know, building my confidence. And part of that was going out and doing voluntary work and being involved in organisations out in the community, which led kind of into politics. So everything's been just a little stepping stone. And I ended up doing a few years in social housing out in South Auckland. And got sort of quite interested in the social justice area of homelessness and lack of housing and how it contributes to poor outcomes for people. Because we know, you know, we've got second, third generation of people who are now growing up, you know, or being born into situations of, you know, their entire whānau has been homeless, essentially. I love my work. I just love my work. It's brought together all the various strands of, my life and my interests. I've always been really, really interested in hearing the stories of others, which is probably why AA resonated with me. you know, hearing and listening to the stories of others. So part of my role at Te Kōrero Timatanga Hou is to assess people for suitability to come into our court. And part of that is sitting, we sit down and I'll talk to them and talk with them for about an hour or so and hope, you know, hopefully get their trust so that they can tell me their story. And to assess whether or not they're going to be suitable to come into the court and whether or not they've got that willingness there to make transformative change in their life. Because if there's one thing that I'm extraordinarily passionate about, it's transformative change, because I've seen it, yeah. I've heard it, I've felt it in AA, I know it's possible. And I've been through it myself. And although I'm still me, but there was a transformative change in me when I got sober. I am the same me, but I am a different version of me. And I do really feel that I've lived two different lives. So I believe that everybody has the capacity for transformative change. My whanau come in and they're people who have no resources, right? And making change is really, really difficult. So if we want to change people's criminal behaviour, we've got to, enable them to access resources. So getting into things like getting them into some stable housing, getting some supports around them in terms of getting things like your basic documents, you know, your basic tools for human life that they often don't have. So no birth certificate, no Kiwi Access card, no bank account. You know, they often don't even receive their benefit anymore because it's been stopped. And just seeing what people are capable of when you just give them a bit of support, you know, in a non-judgmental way. You just, here you are, here's some tools, you know, we'll support. And it's not just the outward things, it's seeing the change within them. So you'll have someone who come in, very, very defensive, very anti-authority, hates the world, you know, everything's negative, whatever. And then there'll be a little something there and you think, yeah, there's something there. And you'll just, maybe you're talking about cars, or maybe you're talking about music, or maybe you're talking about, you'll find some little kernel of hope there that you can
see a little spark.
And you're kind of like, let's focus on that. And it's just so rewarding to build a relationship of trust with someone where they say, okay, yeah, let's give it a go.
And I bet you they really respond to you kind of listening and hearing and seeing them, really seeing them.
I hope so, Lotta. I mean, outwardly, you know, you can be very different to someone, like, but inwardly really understand them. And I think that's the beauty of the recovery community, is that we know the emotions you're talking about. We understand your feelings, you know, we get it. And it's not about this, and it's not about, you know, the brand of your shoes or your car, whatever. Mm. And it's that lovely thing that happens when you get people who have, they're either in addiction or, you know, deep in their alcoholism, and they spend time with people in recovery, and something really special happens. And it's hard to put a finger on it, but you know, I've sat in rooms, you know, very, very ordinary little church halls and things, and you can feel something.
Oh no,
there's a presence there, you know.
Oh,
and
no.
Then sometimes when I'm sitting in my funny little internal office, and outside courtroom one, sitting there, and sometimes you can just feel, you know, there's something happening here.
Yeah,
and it's just beautiful. It's an enormous privilege, you know. I just love it. I love it.
Well,
so
how amazing that you're doing that, Mahi, now, and it's so rewarding, and it's bringing together, like you say, all the strands of your life. And I'm just so, so happy for you that you've experienced that transformative change, and that you've become, you know, the grounded kind of wise giving person that you always were, but that just had all those lost years. It's just been such a joy talking to you, Carmel, and I just so grateful for you opening up to us here at Living Sober. And I know that our members, you know, are really going to enjoy watching this, because like I said to you, you know, many of them, they're in those early stages and it's hard work, and we just want to say keep going.
Yes, please persevere. I this is my diary that I did in my first year of sobriety. Wow. And I just, and the tumult of emotions and how much I miss drinking. Oh. And I just, I want to go back to say to my early self, you know, hang in there, because you have no idea how wonderful your life can be living sober. I just am so grateful every single day. I've got my my family back. I've got, you know, I've got grandchildren who I'm a safe person, you know.
Yes. And you've got yourself back. That's the beautiful thing. You've got how amazing. Look, thank you so much. Really appreciate you. I will share a link to the court if anyone wants to check out just the public website, what the work is that you do. But again, a really big, big thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the time, Lotta. It's always lovely to talk to fellow people in sobriety. I can spend all day doing it, to be honest.
Okay, take care.
And next time you're in Auckland, you know, let's have a coffee. And I'll
love to
when I'm in Wellie. I'm
down there. Great. Yeah. Bye.